around, do little, get little, start for little.
What are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
There you go. That's the man. Now, I can't see Uncle Eddie because we're trying a new setup today, but I can hear him. Now I can see you. There you are. So welcome to another episode, everybody, of What Are You Guys Talking About? We are doing a special Rumford Horror Independent Film Festival episode. We were going to be doing The Love Witch for you today, which we have recorded, but that will be going on next week because we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the films that we saw, a little bit about kind of first impressions, and more than first impressions, really, kind of how we did with it, and just kind of the day's experience. So, you know, before we get too far into it, don't forget that we are always around on www.lovevictoriaproductions.com. That is the best way to kind of see everything that we're doing. Lots of Dirty 20. Dirty 20 video was really good this week. They're all good, but this one was particularly good, so I would go check over that. But there'll be stuff coming up on our Dev Diaries for You Reap What You Sow. The interview I did for Rumford International Horror, or Rumford Horror International Film Festival, will be up there as well at some point when I get it embedded into the website. You can also catch this. I mean, obviously, you're either listening to this on SoundCloud or another podcast, but we are available, as you know, via SoundCloud, also via iPod or podcast on the iTunes Store. Podbean is another one we're particularly popular on, and Player FM also has us. So a couple of different ways you can get us on the podcast. If there is somewhere else that you want it on and it's not on because it's your preferred provider, then just let us know. We're not moving to Anchor FM because we paid the money for this year with SoundCloud, so we'll stay here. Other things to check us out: Instagram, we have Jesse J. Shiro and Nano LVP. Twitter, we have Ananaski Prod. That's his production company, or his old production company. And then, of course, at Mouth Love Victoria, yours truly, always there. And finally, if you want to be all professional, you can find us on LinkedIn. We have a Love Victoria page there with all the same postings that we make round on social media. We're not on TikTok. I am on Snapchat, but I think you have to know me on Snapchat to see my story. So, I mean, I don't really talk to anyone on Snapchat, so it's really just there because I thought it was another social media place that we could possibly get into. And I'm really racking my brain on something fun to put on TikTok, but I'm just too old at the moment. So anyways, that's everything and any way to get a hold of us. We post a lot these days, so please keep in touch. Lots of things going to be coming as well. It's why I make a big deal of it. We're going to be raising money for our short, raising money for the studio. There's going to be some stuff coming up that you'll want to hear about, so please don't make sure you don't miss out by like, subscribing, sharing, getting involved in the LVP community. But without further ado, let me stop talking for a few minutes here while we hand over to Ed and say, Ed, what were your let's do it like first impressions. What would you like to open with about the Rumford Horror International Film, Independent Film Festival, not international, Independent Film Festival?
I'd like to start by thanking Spencer, your good friend who you met at Fright Fest. I think that's a good story that you should definitely tell on this podcast. But he's the organizer of the Rumford Horror Film Festival. And it was the first one they did this year. And the thing that struck me was just how welcoming and how friendly they were to the filmmakers. And I mean, you know, everyone in general. But it was one of the best experiences I've ever had, having a film in the festival. It was one of the best experiences I've had.
Listen, we were only there for a heartbeat, and apologies for that, Spencer. To give you the background to that, my wife and kid were up in Hull for the week, and we had just assumed we were going to go down for the Saturday and Sunday because they were out, and that was just me thinking like a bachelor, not like a dad, because I have a dog, and it was like, well, who's looking after the dog? And it was like, oh yeah, we can't leave her by herself for 12 hours while we're over there. And then on Sunday, like, you know, I'm the guy who takes care of all the food and stuff around the house. My wife drove like 6 hours, so I just couldn't be like, hey honey, by the way, I'm gonna go see The Exorcist right now, I'll see you later. So it just didn't work out that I got more than like 3 hours at the festival. But let me say, like, the time we did spend there, it was just so nice, like, to have that conversation, to be able to do there. So telling the story that Ed's talking about, Spencer Hawken and I met, he said, and I think he's right, about 10 years ago, a little bit, right? Maybe, wow. I can't remember if it was slightly later than that, but yeah, 10 years ago, we were at Fright Fest, and I just sat next to him, because when I first started going to Fright Fest, I had, like, the first one I went to, which I sat next to my buddy Gary, who I haven't talked to in ages, and then I had the next one, which I think it was the next one that I sat next to him, because I didn't know where to sit, because I was hanging out with a bunch of new people, so I just picked a rando seat, and just ended up next to this guy, And I mean, poor thing, right? With the way I talk and the way I go through with movies. But who knows? We ended up hitting it off. And what he doesn't know is, like, that's the early days of me thinking about becoming a filmmaker, because Spencer was. So I was really lucky to be sitting next to him literally as he put out Death Walks, which, if you haven't seen Spencer's right. no-budget zombie film, it's, like, it's filmed at the Mercury Mall, which we were at. Like, it's fun. Like, it's... Mm. It was such a great project, and to hear his stories about submitting, and I mean, he got a lot of flack from people saying there's no way this was no budget. It was. Like, he had a lot of pride in the fact that he had negotiated this down to, you know, a zero cost contract with everybody. And it was one of those things that he was like, I can show you on paper why it's a no budget film. And so, you know,
it's kind of a nice insult, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
it was too good to be zero budget.
Yeah. And it's just the kind of guy he is. Like, because then I found out he knew the lead actress from The Woman, which is Pollyanna McIntosh, I believe is her name, which is, I mean, she's a phenomenal actress. And I would die if, like, not starstruck. She's just a really good actress. It would be really cool. And that's why I was like, you get to talk to her? And he's like, oh, yeah, man, we hang out. And I was like, it just started getting those gears turning in my head back then, saying, like, wait a second, like, if he can do this, like, and not saying anything about you, Spencer, you're a very charming man, but you know what I mean? Like, I just was like, wow, that's really cool. Guy I'm sitting next to at Fright Fest is, you know, the guy who's doing all this stuff. So that's how we met. And he has been, you know, in film and in your media career, because we don't just do, you know, LVP, we do the YouTube stuff as well. He's a really big champion for us. We have people who speak well of us, and we'll say they work really hard. Mm. He's one of them. He will tell you, you know, we post podcast every week, Dirty 20 every week. You know, we always have new material coming. It's nice to have people like that that know that you're doing it because you love it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah? So, I mean, Ed, what were some of the highlights for you? Like, what were some of the things that you really took away from the day as far as them being welcoming? Let's get down to specifics a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, we were very lucky to meet Brad and Louise, his daughter, yes. who are a couple of filmmakers. They were also on the selection committee. And it turned out that Brad was the one interviewing you at in you know, the Q&A at the end, which is kind of cool as well, because he was just so enthusiastic and so, you know, like, interested in your process, and that always kind of bodes really, really well for me. But so one thing that was, like, so funny now looking back on it was the film that we went in to watch. So we go in completely blind, like, you know, we have the schedule and stuff, but we haven't, like, looked into the film or whatever. But we walk in and it's Manos, The Hands of Fate. That's the title.
That is 100 times better. So we are back now. We were talking about Manos, and I'm very much excited now because I can actually see Ed. It's really funny that we had this, like, delay. And this kind of, I couldn't see his screen because he's checking out his new, he's got a new MacBook, the big boy.
Yes.
And yeah, it just really messed up my timings because I was like, dude, I'm getting a delay, blah, blah, blah. And, like, I'm such a diva with stuff like that. So which ends it, we'll talk about what a diva I was on this weekend, because it was nice to pretend at least to be a famous film star with Ed around, you know, acting like my personal assistant, you know. So we'll talk about that and Ed putting up with all my bullshit. While we were there. But let's talk about Manos, because we could probably chunk out a good 20 minutes talking about that freaking film. So, let's tell the story of how it happened, because that's why it's funny. So,
okay.
Manos, right? Hands of Fate. Starts the conversation with Ed, and we were like, you know, we were wondering whether we came late to the VHS documentary film, which we weren't really that fussed about to begin with. We weren't going to make the early film anyway because it was me and Ed. And Ed, I think I told Ed to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, which was a shitty thing to do because, I mean, I wasn't even remotely around until 9 o'clock. And we didn't leave the damn house until, like, 11. So, you know, and that's not how I do production, by the way. That's when I have a day off. So, do you know what I mean? But Ed was very nice in being like, okay, I think we should go now, because we had missed, like, the morning films. So we get to the section where we're looking at the program and it says Manos. And he asked me and he says, like, what's this movie about? And I, you know, in typical Jason fashion, I hadn't really read it. I just, like, looked at it. And I said, well, it's Manos, right? That's the one we should see. It's going to be Spanish or something, man. It'll be like, we love all the Latino films. So we go. And this was right after meeting all the lovely people for the festival. So we were kind of committed to staying in the theater, you know, because we had said to them.
Stuff. Yeah.
But it starts. And, like, I don't know, for me, Ed, and this is where I'll kick over to you to kind of give your first impressions, but for me, like, it started after a bunch of short films, and so I thought we were watching, like, a commercial for, like, something, like, you know, because what happens at these horror festivals is the dudes like to pull out the old adverts from, like, the 70s and be like, wasn't that a funny commercial? And they usually are. Like, sometimes you're like, oh, for heaven's sake. But, you know, I get down with that, so I'm like, okay. And this was definitely old, so I was like, okay. Then it kept going, and I was like, oh, it's the film. And literally, like, after... was it 10 minutes? Then the title comes up and you're like, oh, it is Manos. Holy shit. Like,
yeah. So and we're definitely going to talk about the three short films that came before it.
Yes.
But yeah, Manos was... I think it caught us in a bad moment. And it's funny that sometimes this can happen, right? But we had just watched the night before. We'd watched and we'd done and we'd recorded the podcast for The Love Witch. Now, not to get into that, but... The Love Witch has this great, like, homage aesthetic.
Yeah, right? it's something we know as filmmakers, Ed, don't we? Like, because we had this awesome... This is the thing we'll also talk about in the podcast. Ed and I had this, like, amazing two-day, like, corporate jam session. I call it corporate because it was like one of those away days, but really it was just Ed hanging out with me on my couch, and we have a new patio in the backyard, which was nice, too, and we just jammed. Like, we got so much material.
And the weather was lovely. Like, it was
It was just, like, it was soulful. You know, we went into my forest, right? We had, like, that soulful moment. So, do you know what I mean? Like, it was one of those things that we... love that kind of aesthetic. Like, we want to make a film that will look like that because A, we know how to do it because we watch enough of those films, and B, like, it's just cool. Like, there's never going to be an era in our view again that's quite as glitz and glamour as, like, 60s Hollywood, and The Love Witch epitomizes that. Like, it's that's the whole point of the film. So, you know, first impressions before you even see it now. And we had thought erroneously, like, horribly erroneously, but because I hadn't looked it up, we had thought it's shot on 16mm, so Ed and I were like, wow, like, this is a really, really weird, you know, homage to 16mm.
Yeah. Low budget, made in, you know, last year or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was my thing.
Yeah,
thinking.
I kept, you know, I'm that annoying guy in the movie theater. I know at Fright Fest they'd probably boot me out for this, but there wasn't as many people in this theater, so I could get away with it. But I'm always leaning over to Ed. I'm the producer that talks the whole movie because I want answers to my questions. And my first question was, because I don't know, like, I was like, Ed, how cheap is 16mm? Because, like... You know, I was like, is this homage? Like, can you just make it? Because what happened is, like, the shots were horrible. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, if you're going to make an homage, wouldn't you, like,
timing
choose...
Timing was terrible.
Right. Like, there were all these really horrible parts to him. So, is this just being made because it's so much cheaper, Ed? And he's like, I don't think so. Like, Super 16 still has to be taken to a negative, and you still have to do this with it. And I was like, so why would you make this film?
it was, like, really bizarre. And then, like... So it goes on for a little while, and then people start laughing. And I wasn't getting the joke. Like, I thought, this is just really poor. It's not like, you know, like a spoof or something like that, you know? But, of course, you know, dummies that we are. I turned to you and I said, like, should we go? Because we were, like, what, three-quarters of the way in? Two-thirds of the way in, maybe?
Well, and Mal, Katie and Ashley, because those are, like, my three rogues that were always like, let's go to the bar. I didn't have you guys. And so, and Ed and I don't drink profusely together, usually. And so, when he looked at me, he comes to me and he says, you know, I understood the laughter because I'm used to that. Like, it in Fright Fest crowd, like... If it's shit, they'll laugh at it. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes it's so shit, it's funny.
Right.
And that was definitely what was going on here. But we didn't know that. We were like, wow, I'm glad at least somebody finds this funny. Because, man, I just can't understand why anybody would make this effing film. Why make homage if you're going to make it so shit? And I was being my typical self. Like, my typical, like, I know what I'm talking about. This is crazy. So Ed turns to me and I said, no, Ed, we've come in here. We might as well. And then... I think another 15 minutes goes by and he can see me squirming in my chair and he turns a second time. He's like, really, man, like, do you really want to sit through or should we just get ready to see the short films after? So we pop out. And then the worst thing was, I think there were people waiting for us out there. Weren't there?
not really waiting for us, but some of the organizers had said, oh, you need to talk to this person and this person. And so we got to chat with some of the people helping to organize.
See, I can't even remember. It happened 2 days ago, mate. 3 days ago. So, no, what happened is we went. I remember, like, I said, why don't you get a cigarette? Because Ed still smokes Bad Ed. I said I would come join you because I wanted some fresh air. And then we came back. And that's when, while we were out there, is when I Googled it. And I was like, oh, shit,
that's
Ed.
Right.
And he's like, what? And I'm this is the worst film in mankind. This is worse than The Room. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
this is one of those so bad it's good.
Exactly. Kind of like, it's faded. And then the coolest part about that was, I only knew it was like in the press clipping, like in the thing I read. We walked back into Rumford Horror Festival and there's Spencer, Bradley, and Louise like ready with the story. And they gave us like full on details about this film. Yeah.
They were so enthusiastic and they were like, oh, you left at the best part.
Yeah, so
but I think that's, it's interesting where, like, you know, sometimes, especially in a film festival, you go into a film with no kind of a foreknowledge, you know, and you do kind of have to. Sometimes you walk out, sometimes you just don't get it, you know. Like, I've watched films that later on I liked, which I didn't at the film festival because I wasn't in the right mindset. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the biggest one I can remember that's a great example of this, and we'll talk a little bit more about Manistee because there's a couple other things that we were told that were really good stuff for a podcast, at least. But it reminded me of The Dead. And The Dead was a film I saw, I believe, in my first Fright Fest. Mm-hmm. And I told you about this one. It was one of those, it was a zombie film during the zombie era. And I say that because I saw so many zombie films. Like, if I never see a zombie film again, I'd probably be okay. You know what I mean? Like, there just was a time where, like, every horror movie had to have some element of zombie in it. And it just got old really quick.
This
was another zombie film. And people were hailing it. There were all these people at the premiere. And I was like, I watched it on the big screen and was like, eh. Like, it was all right. It was a zombie film in Africa. And it went from one end of, you know, it wasn't as descriptive as it could have been. It was a zombie film in quote-unquote Africa. So I was like, all right, like, I guess that's a new place, but it's not, it wasn't incredibly descriptive. So I was like,
right.
What's so cool about being in Africa? And then, then I bought the DVD. Don't ask me why. That was the era when I'd buy everything I saw at Fright Fest, whether I liked it or not.
That's
stupid,
awesome.
Spoiled rich kids. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. I rented the DVD, or I bought the DVD, and I listened to the commentary. And then you hear the story of this film. And this film, these two guys got malaria. They were kicked out by, like, two different governments. They were chased through another African country. I mean, it's amazing. It's the whole reason to watch the fucking movie is to listen to the director's commentary, where these two guys almost died trying to put it together. Yeah. And then the funniest thing is then they did a sequel in India. And I was at the premiere of that, and I remember it was another film I wasn't really that impressed with to begin with. But again, I had to go to the premiere because I was so impressed by these two guys. I was like, you know, I may not like your films, but this is where filmmaker to filmmaker, like, I'll pay to see any of them. Because when you put your heart on the line like that, like, these guys, like, one guy will never be right again. Like, he's like, I get malaria attacks all the time. They're kind of shitty. You know what I mean? Ugh. And, like, they have, like, two countries in Africa they're not allowed to go to. Yeah, and I was that's awesome. Like, that's what I want to do.
A story, right?
So
that is a friggin' story, my God.
Right. So, I mean, Manos is similar, right? When you hear about how all this came about and the things in the background, then it makes it much more worthwhile to watch the story. The worst bit was what Spencer told me about the guy with the legs, which was hilarious because you just, like, why don't you explain it, Ed? Because you're better with the visuals. Like, what's with the dude in the legs and kind of who's his character?
So very basically, the story is about a husband, a wife, and their daughter who are driving in the desert. They get lost, and they come across a finca. I don't know how I would describe it, but just like a building. And they go in to try and ask for directions. And out of this building comes what I could only describe as like almost like a gold prospector, you know, from old timey days, but his legs are like, they look really weird.
Yeah, right? I thought originally he might be like a centaur or something like that.
Right, yes, that was my thinking as well.
Because he has these huge bulges on his knee.
Yeah.
And maybe, we never watched the end of the film, so maybe that's the big reveal. I thought it would be. Maybe. I thought it had to be that this guy had centaur legs, but we left.
Yeah.
So
And it was maybe one of the funnier elements. Like, every time he'd walk, he'd do this, like...
Yeah, it was just because, like, this is where you can't tell whether they knew just how funny they were being, and you expect not, but there are these scenes that are written, like, I'm going to call him Mr. Tumnus, because that's what he reminded me of. So, he was like, Mr. Tumnus, can you go get the luggage out of the car? And you're just looking like, why would you make that guy get the luggage? Like, he moves so much slower than the rest of you. And they did it all the time. And
they kept doing it. Yeah, yeah. You do wonder if that was, like, a gag.
But the story was such... I mean, I do love these type of exploitation films because they don't really exist anymore, probably because of the complaints that I made about who would fund a film like that. Right. But... the thing that you used to do in exploitation, I remember this more from martial arts films. So I used to watch, like I told you, I'd buy that 100, you know, martial arts film on one DVD on four DVDs. And a lot of times in those films, I think half the time because they were literally rewriting the story from dubbing, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they make the story come to what's on the screen as opposed to the other way around. In other words, like, the screen doesn't follow the script follows the screen. Because the guy's I got a location here, I'm going to shoot this, so... Oh, wait, the car is going to arrive, and now we'll have them arrive in some mysterious destination they don't know where they are.
Right.
And that's only because, like, he hadn't written a script that went anywhere. So, I guess, you know what I mean? It was funny. The funny thing about the legs guy, though, just to follow this up on that one.
This is the darkly funny thing.
Well, yeah. It's dark comedy at its best. Yeah. Again, we can make the film about the making of the film. That's what I would love to do, you know, the dark humor behind it. So... they never read the instructions to put on the prosthetic legs that he was clearly wearing, and they put them on backwards. He suffered such severe pain from wearing that at first he got hooked on pain pills. Later, he got hooked on heroin because the pain was so bad, and then he died of a heroin overdose at 30.
Jesus, man, that is just like
so Hollywood heavy. Chewed him up and spit him out.
Yeah, man.
Rest in peace, my good man.
They did some sequels, I think. There was like a prequel for his character. His character's name was Torgo.
Torgo, that's it. Yeah.
And it was like the origins of Torgo or something.
Yeah, because apparently Torgo and Manos, just so you know, and just so we can say, fuck you, cultural appropriation, like, there was Manos, right? And we'll get into that in a minute, but Manos and Torgo argue. And then the other scene with Torgo that was important, apparently, because it was Spencer's favorite scene that we missed, was Torgo gets his arm ripped off. And when they do the replacement arm, like the skeleton arm is a stick with bacon on the end of it. Yeah,
that's right. It makes me want to catch it again, actually.
Yeah, no, like, I'm definitely picking this up on iTunes at some point. I nearly did it for the show and was like, well, I'll just watch it again for the show. But no, at some point, I do think I'll have to be quite inebriated to enjoy it. But
I think so. It's one of those, but once you're in the right mindset, I think it might be very
enjoyable. No, that's why these films were popular in college, because once I was in the right mindset, wink, wink, you know, it was like, oh, I love this film. So weird.
Yeah, and this was also part of Mystery Science Theater, which was something
that's where it apparently
came to super late, but
apparently that's where it got its rise to fame. I don't know if you've ever caught that, guys. I'm sure they're available on YouTube or somewhere. But Mystery Science Theater 3000 used to. I mean, it was just this dude and three robots, and he used to watch shit movies and make fun of them. Man, it was funny. Like, it was just so entertaining.
Yeah. Like, crappy old movies. And a lot of these movies got, like, a second life because, you know, they became popular.
It started coining the it's so bad, it's good stuff. There is a lot of that. I mean, that's the thing, guys. Like, the different walks for everybody. I still go back to Butt Boy. I hated the concept of that film, but it received a standing ovation after the third act when we were in the guy's anus. Like, okay. Like, I'm not really going to make films like that myself. That's when you start figuring out your voice as a filmmaker, and I'm like, I'm not sure that'll ever be my voice. That kind of surrealism, that kind of craziness. It might be. I can certainly get crazy sometimes, but it amazed me how much even I was laughing at that film. You know what I mean? Just like, it got me. So this is another one where it's like, okay, well, you know, that Butt Boy wasn't bad. This was bad. And it was like, I guess had I understood how terrible it was, I might have... you know, found it funnier.
Yeah, for sure. But the short films that came before that feature were like, I thought pretty special.
Well, this is the thing, like, and I really debated about this because we had a short film that showed, so I'd like to talk about the short films. I've done that via writing before, so at Fright Fest, I always do my post about all the short films, but I love talking about short films, as long as anyone who made these films listening to me means I'm not being critical, Ed's not being critical. We think just getting it done is amazing, you know what I mean? And we're struggling ourselves to get our stuff done. We know how it is, so as long as everyone listening can take it with, like, a grain of salt that, like, I don't know what I'm talking about half the time, just have opinions, then I'm happy to talk about the short set.
So there were three that played before Manos, The Hands of Fate, and they were The Magpie, The Sleepless, and Blissburger.
Which I rate, like, if I was going to go top three on those three, it went Magpie, Blissburger, Sleepless.
I totally agree. I'll be completely honest. I can't quite remember. Was Sleepless the one about the First World War ghost? Or was that...
No, those are on the quarantine ones, which we'll do... Sleepless, we'll start with that one. And the reason it gets three, you know, this is what I mean. We're going to get into weeds on this because you might be able to catch these at a later time. and if you can't, it's just us trying to give those pointers because that's kind of the crux of the show, is trying to say, well, here's what we saw they did well. The good things that were done well on it, okay, it looked good. Like, it was polished, you know what I mean? It wasn't, there wasn't anything grainy about it. It was shot really well. He did have a lead in there. He had, or at least a name in there, which is big. Like, anytime you can get a name in one of your shorts, do it. Now, we found out later in a snarky comment, you know what I mean? We found out later in a snarky comment that that particular actor will appear in any of the short films of his students, and this was one of his students. So we were a bit like, that explains that.
It's Roberts, Julia Roberts' brother.
Oh, is that who that is?
Yeah, I can't remember.
I have no... See, Ed is so good with this. I'm terrible with names. So, but they had a lead in it, and the premise was okay. The premise, you know, you can't really talk about a short without ruining it for you, so sorry.
Yeah.
But the premise is basically a guy on a psychologist's couch, and what the psychologist doesn't know is he's done something to that guy. That's the easiest way to put it. Now, why was this number three? Because the execution on the psychologist's couch, to Ed and I's view, just wasn't done the way we would do it. And that's just saying that, you know what I mean? Basically, you had a shot-to-shot, you had some dialogue from the couch, and you had some response from the psychologist, shot, counter-shot. That was one of my issues.
I think, completely agree. And you turned around and you said to me, and I was like, oh yeah, you know what, you're right. It felt a little bit safe with its, like, shot choices.
It's just because it's, you know, in a short film, guys, the reason I'm like that as a producer, so this is my producer hat on. As I said, I'll put the writing hat on in a minute and explain that to you. But the producer hat said this needed to be a bit sharper because it's your one chance, right? Like, just like me, you got to sit there and watch your film, but you want it to be the best fucking film anyone's ever seen. So, you know, Ed helped me with that by I just gave him back two books of master shots. Just read them. Literally, you will start designing shots in your head that way, and that's why he gave them to me. You know, his hope is that eventually I'm going to read shot by shot, and then, like, it'll be fait complete. You know what I mean? Like, I'll just be able to tell him, this is how I want to have it done. But this was the thing. With the shots, like, it's just you can do so much more. I had said, why not put the psychologist in a position of power and then switch it? And Ed, you know, Ed and I will explain to you, like, you can do that by angling the camera, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone looks tall, your brain will perceive that as power. If someone looks small, where you point the camera downward, it does just the opposite. So even in just that brief moment, I would have played with that because it's the easiest way, because that's what changes in the short. So the way you could have done that visually is then when the reveal happens, or even before the reveal happens, you change that perspective. And actually, if I'm thinking about it, that's probably what I would have done, because I want the audience to start anticipating something's about to change.
Almost like they know that something's different, right? Yeah, exactly.
Again, this is personal preference and nitpicking to the nth degree, because what's there instead, in my view, was the lead, the writer, the director, the actor decided to take that lead part, and I just don't feel personally like he delivered those lines, you know, with the emphasis that they needed. And it was because it was coming out, and again, it's because he's trying to get the exposition out, and there was a lot to expose on this, and it was a good story, like, it was a good kind of revenge tale. However, like, the way it was delivered, it just, and I don't know whether that's because he was directing himself or, you know, we've seen that happen before. I've been guilty of that plenty of times.
That was perhaps my kind of biggest pet peeve with it, was, like, there was a lot of kind of dramatic moments in the script, and my thought was immediately, okay, this is probably an actor who's written it for themselves to, you know, add to their showreel, which, again, I have absolutely nothing against that, you know. But also the black and white choice, I just, you know,
I wasn't sure we had a discussion with someone about this, and I won't name you on this, but you'll know who you are because I imagine you're listening to us now. Thank goodness. Welcome to the show. Listen, like, we had a long conversation with this with Adam Stovall, both on the air and off the air.
That's true.
Pick up any, like, Guerrilla Filmmakers Handbook will put it in there and tell you, like, rule number 7 is thou shall not. These are the 10 commandments. Thou shall not shoot in black and white.
Mm.
Listen, I agree with that, okay? Like, Pi, very cool in black and white, but it was made to be in black and white. Like, so many films are not made to be in black and white. You want color. You want drama. You want... because there's so many cool things you can do with it. You know what I mean? So, just always second guess it and third guess it. Because we saw quite a few black and whites, didn't we? In the short amount of shorts we saw...
Yeah, it's a very common, like you say, it's you know, it's a there's a reason why it's in the
mise-en-scene, one of them, right? Mise-en-scene's one of them that everybody laughs when you try to do that unless you're 1917 or One Shot of the Dead. So it can be done, but don't do it. You know, not unless you've got a good reason to do it. Black and white, same thing. What's the other one? There's one I just missed, and there's three, and I can't think of what the other one is. That's cliche that everybody always does.
I mean, the one that I always heard was don't have either it all be a dream at the end, or the character commits suicide.
Oh God, yeah, no God, that's the Dallas ending. Yeah, no, the dream thing. Like, nothing pisses off an audience more, being like, what? No, I just thought of it though. It's and not also remember that. But the fourth thing I would add to that is the, and I forgot it again. Damn it, Ed, give me another.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. What are the things? What
cliches
are the common pitfalls
in film? Oh, I know what it is now. Sorry. The cliche in film was don't make a film about filmmakers. And people break that one all the time. And we've seen, you know, one cut of the dead. It breaks both of those rules. It says it's a one shot, or at least it's made to be a one shot, and it tells you all about the background. So you can break the rules. All we're saying, because this is about, like, general points, is don't. Just don't.
But your first instinct should be, yeah, I shouldn't do that. But, you know, it's also true for things like voiceover. But then if the story really calls for it, then it's not, you know, cliches are cliches for a reason, because they've worked in the past in stories.
Right.
What about Blissburger?
Yeah, so, I mean... that was only the reason why, if we put the three together, we were like, well, that one, that middling bit, we didn't quite get. But the reveal at the end was cool. You know what I mean? There was a really cool bit at the end, and it did deliver. Like, again, plenty of short films don't even do that. Plenty of short films don't deliver. You know, we've seen them at festivals. And this one delivered. This one gives you the revenge and everything you're looking for. So, Blissburger. This one, awesome and then weird at the same time.
Yeah, I completely agree. There were moments, and it happened, like, kind of throughout the film, where I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then there were other moments where I was like, I'm not 100%.
Yeah. It was one of those films that I think, first of all, like, to me, it came across as a pitch for a feature. And I think the feature would be better because you'd have more time to set out. I think it just suffered from the fact that you've only got so much time. So there's a bit of art to it, which I really liked. It's a commentary on coming to America and, like, the America sanitation of your mind. And so there's this great... it kind of... you've seen Season of the Witch. That's where he's pulling a lot of these things from, I think. I don't know the director. But there was very much Season of the Witch in this, where people are watching TV. There's a really bland voice on the TV. And they're doing things that are very bland, you know. And the whole thing with this is people eat burgers to the TV. And it's like, Blissburger will make you feel all right. The closest thing that's been done recently for that is the Hands Across America kind of stuff that's in Us. That's a similar kind of throwback. So this is where he's borrowing all that from. Interesting is it's an Indian immigrant who's really communicating, at least predominantly in Indian, with his wife back home. And there's all these things about being an immigrant in a new country that they're kind of bringing up.
And also, like, kind of a commentary on fast food culture and you know.
That's the thing. I didn't quite understand the ending, but I think what it was trying to say was that the guy had become morbidly obese because he was, you know, it's like saying that he turns to McDonald's when he has a bad day.
Right, and
definitely, that was not what it was not literally shown, but I think that's figuratively what the different scenes was trying to put together. And it just, I think that was part of the problem, is at the end, Ed, there's no monster. And you need a monster. And it's kind of like what you said, like, don't make it all a dream. And it was like, unfortunately, the end almost is like that. It's not quite. Like, it's a reveal.
Yeah.
It's
one of those where it's like, okay, was it all in his head? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Which is a little bit in that vein, isn't it?
So, but overall, like, if I'm producing this and I'm saying, would I take this to an investor and say, I'll help promote this film? Yes. Yes, I would.
Yeah.
Like, I would on this one. This one gets a thumbs up from Jason. Not that the others wouldn't. It's just this one I could see where he wanted to go with it. And I was like, that's a good concept. That's cool. And that's expandable. I could make a feature out of that. You could get 70 minutes of footage, maybe. The thing I was on the fence about, Ed, that I'd love to hear your views on. So, the Indian thing. Like, I get it. Part of the producer in me would say that zeitgeist. We are now in an environment where we can do that. We can say, no, this isn't the Indian American experience. This is the Indian experience. And we're supposed to be telling those new stories from new perspectives. So, totally respected that. However, couldn't get past the fact that having it in a foreign language and having it with Sanskrit was jarring. You know what I mean? Like, it just took me out of the message. So I was like, what do you think? Was it better to to maybe follow Zeitgeist, and it seems like the director's own mind, and put that in there? Or would you have said, no, for a bigger audience, I still would keep this, you know, in English?
I think it would depend quite heavily, because if the director came to me and said, look, this is kind of my father's story. My father, you know, left my mother to go to get a PhD, and they were apart for a really long time, and it was really difficult, and I want to kind of, you know, have that be a part of the story. In that case, I would be like, okay, that's great. But, you know, if it's just it'll just be, like, cooler or more interesting. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those where I feel like you need a good justification for it.
That's the thing. It didn't have, like, I had a real problem with Slacks, and a lot of people love that film about the killer genes, but my problem was that, like, you had a film that was dishing on India, you know, on the practices of making fabrics and textiles in sweatshops in India, with a cast and a crew that were all wearing designer clothing. And it was just like, I'm just the kind of person, I can't stand that kind of hypocrisy. Now, I am sure everyone is going to watch a bunch of my films and be like, dude, you did the exact same thing. It's just because I can't get on the wavelength. But this was different for me, because there wasn't hypocrisy here. It was clear, like, director had some sentiment here, and he was trying to put it in his own story. And I'm a big advocate of saying, well, if it's your story, then tell it your way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, especially for a short film versus a feature. But I just couldn't get over the fact that I liked the concept, but it was slightly lost in the fact. So, I mean, is it better to keep the concept alive, or is it, you know, that's what I mean. And I think what it comes down to then, from the writing perspective, is it may have been trying to put too many things in at once.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Interesting.
You know what I mean? Is it Blissburger that we're talking about? Is that look how the obesity increases because of this?
Right.
Or is it, look how hard it is? You know, it's a short film, guys, and so you really do have to pick the one thing you want to say, not the 10. And so do you want to say he's an immigrant in a country and it sucks? Or do you want to say,
focus on that,
you know what I mean? They are connected. So with a longer story, you can, that's what he was trying to show. Like, you can say, okay, like, he's been pushed into being this guy because everybody sucks and no one helps him out. Like, I got that. I definitely picked up on it. It's just because it was, you know, I'm making this motion with my hands and no one will see it, but it just was, you know, it just was disjointed. And it's the one thing I do like to say that I think, you know, and as I said, listeners and viewers and whatever, you'll tell me, this is something I think I'm good at. You know what I mean? I think I'm pretty good at telling you where the story can be cut or where it's not coming through clearly. So, I don't know. I mean, it's the kind of thing. It wasn't a bad one, but in the same sense, it fell short, I think, of what it could have been. Is it good enough to get a feature? I thought so. That was my view. So, hey, Blitzberger, if you want someone else to help promote your film, then I'll always come in there.
Uh, And then finally, Magpie, the Magpie, sorry, directed by Oliver Steele. What did you think about that one?
I mean, this was our favorite of the fest. You know what I mean? This was the, from what we saw, this was the best thing we saw. It was amazing. And then the thing I love most about things like this, so we were setting up for interview, and I knew the guy who's interviewing Brad was talking to the directors of this right in front of us. And Ed says, is that Magpie? And I just walked right over to him and said, hi, guys. Because, like, I was so impressed. And it's amazing when you do that, because then they're like, oh, thank you so much. And we mentioned that Dandelions played Fright Fest, and all of a sudden I was the guy they wanted to talk to. Guys, I thought that was hilarious, because I was like, you know, you're so talented at what you do. But then the cool stuff happens, and you start having a conversation about how it's shot and what they know and what you know and how you can work together. Man, that was fun. Because, like, every aspect of this, like, it's very much our style. Like, it was very indie. You know, she was talking about having being stuck in this. You know, remember when she was saying that? Because there's a scene where she gets her jeans wet in this pit, and she's like, she's...
So, shall we just talk about the story of the short first?
That's right. Sorry, I have about 20 magpies in my garden, so I need no explanation for this. But you might, because you might not know why it's called Magpie. Ed, take it away.
So, Magpie, it's a really great setup. It starts with a phone call. I thought it was a brother's calling his sister. He's worried about her. She's just had an operation, and the whole time the thing is pushing in on this girl who's sitting on a woman who's sitting on like in a field, and she has a tattoo on her back which looks like a kind of titanium plate. So the setup is brilliant. But then it goes on where she is...
Yeah, doesn't she have... Sorry, just details. Like, didn't she have the periodic element of titanium, like,
on her back? Yeah. The tattoo on her back had, like...
Is the elemental symbol for titanium, right?
Yeah, and it looked like kind of maybe that they'd put, you know, a chunk of metal, titanium, in her spine or something. That's the vibe that you got. Which is great visual storytelling.
That's
right?
What I was like, just going to point out, because there were so many elements of this. The reason we loved it so much is because it was like, that's how we would make it. Like, and I hate that becomes, oh, that's why we like it, but for the purpose of the show, why not? Like,
we agree with that. That was like a great choice.
Visual storytelling, something that we're just always big about, because we're just as guilty of it. Everyone's used to writing out a story, like, no, show it, and that's what they did. They like pointed to this thing, and they were like, you need to, you know, you clearly knew you needed to pay attention to this TI tattoo on her back, and that, it was like, well, what is that?
Yeah, and which is important for later, right? Because it turns out that she is... she's got a metal detector, and she's going along the forest looking for, you know, valuables. There's a whole subculture.
That's how Sutton Hoo was discovered. You know what I mean?
Yeah. She eventually stumbles across what looks like, someone has put things together that they found. Clothes hangers with, you know, kind of necklaces or something on it, and then like feathers, and she keeps going further, and she finds what looks like a massive den. It's out in the open, but there's like jewelry, there's all kinds of stuff, and she starts like picking up like rings and putting stuff on.
Right, and the other thing to mention here, this is where I like the title choice, because if you know what a magpie does, this is when the dread starts building, and you're like, wait a second, like, that's an awful big magpie nest. Because that's what they do, guys. They steal metal things all the time. I lost my first wedding ring. You know, I'm not married twice here. I've got a new wedding ring. But my first wedding ring, we're pretty sure, is in the nest of some magpie somewhere around this forest.
Son of a gun.
No, they just do that. You know what I mean? You get used to them picking up metal. Yeah. We saw them pick up a mouse once. Like, apparently they can't eat mice. Like, we watched them take it and carry it away. And it was one of those frightening things, not because... You know, mice get eaten out here all the time, but it was more like, we didn't know magpie did that.
and then there's kind of a monster reveal.
Yes.
I thought they did a fairly good job of, clearly, you know, not a huge budget. They went with costume over, like, makeup or anything like that. But the sound design was really fantastic. The... the pace of, like, seeing the magpie was just very short and, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought they sold it well. That's the thing,
like, I find that monsters that have a bird background tend to all look like, and you'll know this because you're playing, I'm not sure you're playing this one yet, but all look like the doctors, you'd like this, the doctors from Venice, and the doctors from
the
Renaissance and stuff like that, with the long mask, because everybody likes that bird mask and that wax, because they used to wear the wax to keep the plague off of them, right?
Yeah, the plague.
So doctors, I find that low-budget bird monsters do take on this. This one was well designed, though. It still had all we're saying is what you do with the costume then is come up with some tricks, some cool things to look at, you know what I mean? Just design it in your head and then write it out. There was enough there that it was visually appealing, but not show stealing, you know what I mean?
And like I say, the way it was shot, the way the sound design was done, I thought that they did a lot with very little.
Exactly. I think we were so impressed. So the VFX shot was the only one for me where it just was preference on that, because it was this yellow. It showed, basically, we come to the end and the magpie's looking for the metal and he can see metal through these yellow VFX. Now, a lot of that will be determined by what they had available. You know, we're kind of the same way. We can't afford big VFX, so if we know how to do one, we'll just do it that way. And so, for that, the aesthetic, I was like, oh, well, I might not have done that, but it still worked anyway. And set up the film great. And it was just, after talking to them, like, it was, you know, amazing, because they were the keenest too, you know.
Well, that's where, you know, we get to the point where you were about to talk about, because she then realized that she's wearing metal and she kind of starts getting rid of stuff. And she's trying to hide from it, and so she goes into a bog. And this is where you were talking to her, and she said
she could barely get out of it. You know what I mean? It was
a wrong step, and she was going kind
straight
of
under.
In.
So, and we know how that is, right? Sometimes it's the location you need.
Yeah. And then, of course, the kind of payoff is that while she's hiding and she's gotten rid of all the metal, she suddenly realizes and remembers, like, the plate in the back of her, you know, that we saw with the tattoo and stuff. And that's when the magpie kind of sees her. Just overall, it looked so good. And then we got to talk to them, and they shot it on a DSLR, but it still looked fantastic.
Yeah, no, I mean, you wouldn't know. Like, it's 4K all the way. You know, and the other thing is, like, it's simple, complete in there. And I guess the reason I like it as a producer is, like, I could expand this one if they wanted to make Magpie. That's one of their deaths. And then they could find the other six or seven, whatever they wanted to do. But it's a monster that goes after metal. I'm sure we could come up with some more ways to do that. Easy and executed. So well done. But even if you're not going to make that film, this is an easy one to set up and say, well, these two can clearly go from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So, you know, put them on your film. You know, let them write your next one. So it's just easier to promote because they show that they have the chops. Not that the other films didn't do that. It's just this was the easiest one to say, that's their calling card. Look, they know how to do horror. It's easy.
They did
this on a DSLR with no money, and look how good it is.
Amen.
So, yeah.
So those were the three short films that played before Manos, The Hands of Fate.
That's right.
But then we also got to see the Cheap Thrills category,
which was really cool. It was similar to kind of what Laurie did originally. So for the first Dandelions, that's how he did it. Obviously, it was promoted for a one-minute short fest, which I think we were number 46 in that one, coming through or number 43 or whatever it was. And there were a bunch of other quarantine shorts. So, and we're just going to talk about, you know, I'll go through them and see if Ed remembers them, because there were a lot of them. I might not remember them all either. But we'll just talk about them. And then I guess we'll close a little bit. I'll tell you a little bit about... I'll be a little bit of Diva Jason and tell you about my great day in front of the screen. So, but the first one was Leash, Ed. Do you remember that one?
I don't. Can you remind me?
Leash was
just... Do you want to just go through all of them and do highlights?
Yeah. I mean, the films that we saw, in case you're interested to find them yourself, there was Leash, The Allotment, Dandelions, What You Can't See, Outbreak, Smiling Woman, The House at the End, and Kidnap. All of them, just before we say anything about any of them individual, all of them were good. There wasn't one that we saw.
There were a couple more. There was Long Pig as well.
Oh, sorry, I just missed this last line. Yeah, Long Pig, Cold Color, and Cutstein.
That's right, yeah.
So all of those were really good too.
Yeah. Special mention for me for Cutstein. It opened with that beautiful little kind of you know, message that the director put out, which I
thought was testament to the programming. I would say, I mean, that was probably the best out of the lot, if I was going to say that, you know, even over Dandelions. I'll admit it. And it was a great one to end on. It just had there was a minor feel-good factor with it because it was very personal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Leash, all of these are short shorts. And so, just like Dandelions, like, these were designed, you know, in extreme budgets. And so Leash is literally a guy walking around with a leash, and then he keeps running into things. And everything story is done through quick cuts and sound. But again, if you want to learn how to do things with quick cut and sound, watch Leash. Like, it's really good. No, it won a ton of awards.
It
won at least 3 awards, I can see on the thing there. But, you know, it is a great example of what you can do with very little. Every time I watch these, Ed, I keep looking out my backyard because I've got my DSLR, you know, my Panasonic. You know, it's not a DSLR, sorry, my Panasonic just there, you know what I mean? And it's like, why am I not just setting this thing up and trying to do some of these little ones?
It is a DSLR, right?
Yeah, I think so. Micro Four Thirds, so yeah,
It's a good little camera. I love the Panasonics. Allotment was quite fun.
Ah, so the allotment, was that the one with the guy with the chopping shears?
No, that was the one with the guy with the baby mask, who was like, and he chases him into the allotment.
Oh, yeah.
So that was kind of silly fun.
I think we can chalk it up to that. Yeah, I kind of remember that one now. So yeah. All right. Silly. I remember the silly mask because it was like, that is an interesting choice. But no, the thing that happened with the allotment that I remember, as in each of these has something, and what this one had was the gore. It had a gore scene, if I remember, that was good. And that was another, if you have like a 1-minute short, make something gory, make something visually cool.
Yeah. Because he stuck the shears like into the guy's back at the end, right? it was fun. I enjoyed it.
So, and then there was What You Can't See. I think this is the one you were talking about with the World War One guy.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this one. Sure. This one, like, I could see what was trying to be done, but it was kind of all the things that I tend to try and avoid in terms of, like, long shots and just everything being a little bit just too long. Because there was stuff in there that I thought was quite cool and would have made a good 5-minute short or whatever, you know. But it was at least 10, I think, if not longer. And it just felt a little overly long for me.
Yeah, and this was another one I remember. This had a lot of things going on in it. So there was this, like, the World War One bit was kind of almost an aside to some of the other stuff happening. But again, it was all happening at once. And so this is the problem when you have a really short film. It's like, pick your one thing, because at least then you can focus on it. And this is Jason talking about that, man. Like, I'm the most the least focused person in the world sometimes, but all I'm saying is you want it to shine, right? And I like the concept. It was like this World War One, not poltergeist, but World War One ghost that was causing problems for other people because of this. Like, I remember this now. There was a dig that this guy's girlfriend was doing.
Girlfriend was on.
And so this guy was suffering from that. And that's such a great concept because she was like a million miles away. And he's sitting at his place and he's wondering why all this shit's happening to him. There's this butterfly necklace that gets exchanged because of this. But the problem is that was all the things that were being thrown into it. The distance in the relationship and the kind of the discussion. And like you said, the biggest problem was the long shots. Like, and that, to me, that was just because it was probably a first-time filmmaker, because I've done that too. You know what I mean? And it was like...
But see, whereas in Dandelions, you know, like, you know, you have that really long, slow-motion shot to the music, that really works. Like, sometimes it's great, and you know, Brad was very complimentary about that. But, like, I remember there was the shot of the butterfly necklace right at the end, right? Because he's, like, dragged away, and the necklace,
that's right.
Like,
he's slipping it out of his hand,
Yeah, and I thought, see, that was a great choice. That was a shot that needed to be exactly that long. And it did, it was a fairly long shot, you know, but... Some of the others,
it suffered from, and we've heard this criticism. This is another cliche, and this isn't saying the director did a great job with this. So I'm not saying you're guilty of cliche. I'm saying this is another cliche he's talked about, the use of people talking on their phones. There was a lot of that because it was the only way I think they could have gotten some of this dialogue done. However, like, First of all, it doesn't look natural. It looks completely unnatural on screen when you do it that way. Don't ask me why.
Especially that way, yeah. Especially the way he did it, which was like just
putting long shots. Yeah, long shots on the couch. You know, and so the that's screen, why you and know, the girlfriend our, just our fully on
the screen.
It was, intercut, it was a little you know, intercut odd. More, just more between the face and the face. Maybe not even and show the phone. It as well. Just yeah. like close up of the face, there close you go. Up. You know, you can almost do shot. Contra shot even in COVID conditions if that yeah. makes sense
and bring more tension, you know, get extremely close up, like, you know, bring attention to details. I
was gonna say, so the long shot at the end of Dandelion, like, had I wanted there to be a feeling of dread, which I could have done because there's also supposed to be a little bit of that, it was more the feeling was more for me of sadness because I was trying to sorrow. Talk about I felt bad completely. About Catherine losing her childhood because of this disease. Mm. And that was the whole point yeah. of the film. So
and it that's comes, why and it comes off so beautifully in that shot. In fact, like, I can't like believe that you didn't have it in the you know, in the 1 minute, because I know it was the struggle was to get it you know, as short as you
well and see it, I found out too, and I'll set it straight on the podcast, I lied in the interview and was like, oh, it was an accident, I wanted more coverage. No, when I sat with Becky, because she remembers things like this, she's like, no, because Becky was DOP on the day and she was the one that we were walking out and she said, why don't you flick the camera back on, and I accidentally filmed it in slow-mo. You know, because nice. I hadn't switched the slow-mo settings off yet.
Amazing, so, amazing accident.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's why everything was taken care of in the edit. When I went through the footage, then it was like, oh, I've got more here. I can do more with it. And I guess all I would say again with what we were talking about with this is, if you want to build suspense the way it was done in that, the better way to do it is through quick cuts, because you don't want the audience to get comfortable. You want them to feel increasingly uncomfortable with the scene.
And yet, I can totally understand... Because the vibe, the ghost, you know, and wanting like a languid pace, like, I can totally see having made that choice myself, you know.
So that's just was our thoughts on that one. Let's move on to Outbreak, because that was an interesting one.
Okay, can you remind me?
Reports of strange and aggressive behavior pour in across the country, spreading the nation into a widespread panic.
Yeah. This was really cool.
Yeah, I thought this was one of the better ones. I mean, this was using... There was that thing that came out during COVID where you could pretend you were on the news, and man, they used that, like, a million times.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, interesting. I didn't know that.
No, they made tons of, like, little things where you could insert yourself into the breaking news, and, like, yeah.
That's so funny. There was lots of that. But I really like the... Because, again, it borrows a little bit from Us, the kind of... craziness of looking at someone doing something really weird and then having them like chase you, you know. So it was a lot of like video footage, you know, like the news reporting about like what's going on, and it was just really clever, I thought.
Now I can't remember if there were two shorts about this or there was only one. Was this the one where they made like the alien noises?
Yeah, that's exactly the one, yeah.
Right, and then it was followed by The Smiling Woman, by the same director.
Yeah.
Right, so this was where we got a bit confused, yeah. And it's funny because I'm just saying this because I can say it on the podcast, but I love you, man, but when his name came up, like in the credits, like I felt like this had been made by like a 16-year-old kid. Like it just felt really young. Like, not that it was a bad film, it was good, by Alex Monagano, whatever his name was, and I was like, oh man, this guy looks like he's making it out of his basement or something like that. But like some kid that's just really talented, you know?
And I think that is one of the things that I really liked about Outbreak, is that it felt like something that a young person had made, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Like it felt contemporary and stuff like that.
And it was good. And again, this is all showcasing no to low budget. Like this was just done with phones and with people running it. Like this is something anybody could have done. It was done during quarantine, clearly, because he just assembled, you know, the different people to do different shots. So the same guy does the next one, which is The Smiling Woman. To be fair, because this was the one that was weird, though, because this had like two credit announcements. It was almost two shorts.
It played twice. Like it accidentally played twice.
Yeah, but then it also had another part. So there's The Smiling Woman at the train station. But then there was The Smiling Woman in the parking lot. And both of those had like cuts to his name directed by...
Like halfway through.
Don't you remember that? Like it was two separate shorts.
Yeah, I do remember that. I just remember that, like, the second half of it was played again.
Right, so this is how we saw this guy's, like, three films, which played out as four. We saw Outbreak, then his credits came up, then Smiling Woman, which was really two shorts, one about a smiling woman in a train station, or a train depot that's empty, that was really good, and then a later one with the same woman, you know, at a parking lot, and that was, it just kind of continued the creepiness, but there was a break in the middle, so... And then the second one, I
do remember that the yellow woman in the parking lot was the girl from the
train station. Right. That's why it was a bit weird, because all of a sudden, like, he cut from Outbreak to Smiling Woman, and then this was Smiling Woman again. And then the parking lot, it played twice.
It played again. It was
so weird. Welcome to Film Festival Happiness.
Yeah,
guys.
Exactly.
Exactly.
I
was like, okay.
I was just, seriously, it does kind of sink my heart when, you know, a film gets played and the sounds are on, they've got to start it again and stuff like that. So none of that happened, so they did an amazing job. The worst thing that happened is that one half of one got played twice.
Fine. We all laughed the second time as much as the first, so, you know.
Yeah.
So that was that one, and we really liked his stuff. Like, it was very low budget, but it was down and dirty our style. So cheers to, as I said, I'm not remembering the name. It was Manganya or
Alex Manganya. Yeah.
Manganya. Yeah. He did a wonderful job with those, you know, and I just love how it was presented almost as a trilogy as well. I like people who kind of think through stories like that, because you can almost connect the Outbreak to the Smiling Woman, but I wasn't quite there with it. You know what I mean? I was like, I wondered if they were interrelated. Because of that. So then we moved to The House at the End, and this was the one that did a lot. Remember how we were talking about Dissolves? Because I think this was one that maybe used Dissolves, did it? Because this is the one where the house goes from 6999 to 666.
I think that was done via
Dissolves.
It was Dissolves, yeah.
Which we've just had a discussion about Dissolves and making a werewolf via Dissolves. So.
Yeah, and this is probably an example of how not to do it. I don't know, maybe that's too harsh. This is, you know, black and white and very clearly kind of low budget. Do you know what I mean? And that's not to be disparaging.
I quite enjoyed this one. Yeah, it had the elements of... There's a funny story at the end of this one too, Ed. But it had elements that I liked about it. I do definitely like that Dissolve kind of environment where... Because the whole idea is they were changing this house every time for a new person to come in and have something bad happen to them. And I like that.
I don't know. It looked very cheesy to me. That's just my opinion.
That's okay. The funny story is, in the middle of this thing, one of the actors and the director, I found out later, because he's one of the filmmakers... He was wearing, like, these pants, right? These trousers, sorry. Trousers. And they were, you know, the dude just had a good figure. They were really tight. But I was like, man, check out those pants. Believe it or not, Ed, I went to go take a piss after the movie, and I'm standing next to the guy in the bathroom.
That's hilarious.
I should have said hello and be like, man, I love your pants. But
yeah,
I just couldn't because I was like, oh, my God, you're the dude I was talking about with the pants. They're awesome, man. They're awesome. So... It's all right. Eddie had his Bruce Lees on the day anyway. So we know all about the cool pants.
That's right. I was peacocking.
That's right. So then we had Kidnap, which was very short. Probably one of my favorites because of how short it was. And it was hilarious. I just love that kind of stuff.
It was a really good gag, and quite scary as well. Like,
I just think of it this way. The way I look at something like that is like, look at it. Like, you're getting into a film festival for 30 seconds of footage. Like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. All day long. It was a good short one to catch. It had to do with, like, a child they thought were sleeping but was really dead.
It's all about, like, parents, you know, with the baby monitor, new baby. Oh, just let him sleep through it. But actually, like, there's some scary shit happening, you know, in the crib and stuff. But short, sweet, like a good gag to it. Also one of my favorites.
Okay, now coming on to... One that I loved. I absolutely loved certain parts of this film, but I hated the whole thing together, and it was long.
Yeah. Yeah, this felt like style over substance. Like, you know, I'm going to make a film that looks amazing, but then the story was just...
No, I like the story. See, here's the thing. Like, I really like the story. I thought the story was easily could have held up on its own without the extras, but the extras... were just disturbing. Like if I'm looking at this as, am I going to take this filmmaker and am I going to put him in front of an investor and say he can do it? Like, first of all, the credits, the title and whatever, were done in this really, really glammy kind of... It wasn't even glammy. It was like a death metal, like, yeah, in-your-face, extreme punk rock style. Yeah. Just didn't fit the story of the film. The story's not punk rock. The story has to do with, you know, eventually it's revealed there's this missing child, but the story has to do with this woman and this old man eating and the attention they take in eating, at least the woman takes, in eating this food. And that's where it shines, because these eating scenes were long, a little bit too long for my good, but but the visuals were there. Like, you were freaking out. It was disgusting, and you knew...
So the filmmaker's Italian, and for some reason, that makes perfect sense to me.
Oh, don't do that on the podcast, though. We have all the Italian guys yelling at us. We're sorry.
No, 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 but in a good way. Like, you know how, like, the giallo, the spaghetti western... Like, all of these elements, they just had something about them, right? And I think that a lot of that is like, Italy itself. And so, this...
Yeah, but this guy could have been Italian-American. Like, I don't know. Was it from Italy?
It was from Italy. They were, you know, all the news was in
Italian.
They
were Italians.
And, it looked great. There wasn't enough there for me.
That's the thing. That's the thing. It can look great, but Ed's just dancing back because I called him out on the Italian thing. But, you know, it can look great, but the problem here was it looked too great. Like, I don't need... I had these three actresses that drive by in the beginning that have no other part in the film. They shouldn't have been there. They should not have been there. They're three cast members that you either had to pay or convince to come on set that you shouldn't have done either. So... It just added nothing to the story, at least as far as I knew. Did they later connect somehow to the story, or?
No, it was another weird thing. I think it was probably like a funny misdirect, like, oh, these three young girls are a party, this is a horror film, of course they're going to die. But it didn't land.
And that makes sense, and we've had to kind of educate on that before, because it's like, misdirect work if you have a strong story. And the problem is, in a short film, like, why are you going to misdirect anyway? You don't have enough time to misdirect. So here, that's actually a really good explanation, because I bet you that's right. You know what I mean? But the reason it doesn't pull off is we never spend enough time with those girls to think. You know, the best misdirect that I can remember of recent times, I mean, it isn't even that good, is Quentin Tarantino when he did Death Proof. You know, that's a deliberate, you know, the whole thing is he sets you up with four characters that you don't know are going to die. And then they die halfway through the film, and then you're introduced to four new characters that you're worried are, like, going to have the same thing happen to them, and then the opposite happens. That's Death Proof, guys. But that's Death a good misdirect, because it's like, it's one of those things that I had enough time to build with those first four characters that it builds into the second, so I feel it both ways. Here, I think the girls had all of, like, 3 seconds on screen, so... And they drive away from the trailer, and you're like, well, if they're driving away from the trailer, where's the danger? You know, maybe if they'd driven towards the trailer, you know, that's all we mean is it took a really good concept, because, you know, again, there's this child that's been eaten, and you realize this ridiculous woman's been eating the child. Like, that was creepy. Like, that was generally creepy, but it was lost, like, kind of in between everything else, I think. Yeah? All right, man, let's move on to Cold Collar. What did you think of Cold Collar? This was the Shears.
Yeah. I you know, well done for getting a film made, and well done for getting into a festival. Like, that respect. Because that shit ain't easy. Wasn't my cup of tea, but, you know, well done.
And what were some of the issues you had with this one? Because I think we share very similar views on that part.
Whatever it was shot on, it wasn't good enough quality. The shots, again, are way too long. The whole thing is way too long. Like, it could have been done in, like, about 3 minutes, probably, because the cold caller comes in right at the end, and it takes about a minute for the kind of kill to happen. And I think that it's, you know... I get the theory of setting up the tension, and what is he doing? He's uncovering this strange statue in the forest, the overgrown nature. So, you know, I get that. It just wasn't executed to my taste.
No, I hear you. And it's another one where, you know, I guess I can... I was the same way with... I'm the ruthless cutting guy, right? Like, I just can't stand long anything. And so with this one, like, but I get it because it reminds me, like, when I first did Dandelions, right, and sent the one-man version out to Laurie and his crew, one of the complaints that they made that I really tried to listen to was, I know that you know the story, Jason, and you know exactly where this is going to go. However, from watching it, we don't. Like, it doesn't all make sense. And that's why, you know, if you watch the interview, I tacked in those other bits because I was like, well, I'll try to explain it a little bit better. It's a short film, so you're never going to get it all the way out there, right? But here, I just thought the elements weren't explained well enough. And I'm not sure even the title, Cold Caller, it was like, it really just gave me the punchline.
Yeah, exactly. It's an odd choice.
So it was, you know, first time filmmaker or maybe not a first time filmmaker, but someone who's, you know, learning on their filmmaking, and it was a good, you know, it had a story and it went somewhere with it. It's just we would have made it a little bit tighter. But let's move on to, and I'll let you probably do most of talking with this, because this it did make me think of you a little bit, Ed, because it's someone who clearly has that long term love of film. But Kutstein.
Kutstein, yes. Directed by, and I'm sorry if I butcher this, but Hamidreza Kushbazan. From Syria, I believe.
I'll read you out this because I didn't even...
Iran, right?
Yeah, it's life of an editor who works for an Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting and feels like Frankenstein, creating a monster imaging all movie sequences have been done with a cell phone. So
yeah.
You could tell that, you know, but I say that you could tell that, but you'd be impressed that you could tell that.
Yeah. He's very clearly a very talented editor and someone who likes cinematography because, you know, he included his parents. And it's basically a montage of some voiceover conversations that he has with his kind of clients, his bosses, who keep asking him to change things and make little tweaks and here and there and stuff. And anyone who's edited professionally knows the pain that is, like, revisions and stuff like that. So there's that, but then there's also a very kind of sweet, melancholic reflection on, you know, his choice to be a storyteller and how his mother kind of talks to him, how his father talks to him, you know, and how his bosses talk to him. And I just... aside from, you know, being very sweet and having a very quirky and interesting story, I liked what he did by, you know, putting together images of video games and cuts from, like, adverts and movies.
That's right. I mean, one of the reasons they love this one was because it came out of Iran. And this was, you know, one of the things that was a big deal for them. But in the film itself, there's some very... I mean, he's an editor, and he's making a commentary on what he has to have let the government say and what they broadcast. Yeah. And part of the end of it is him... the Frankenstein part comes in that you will see that he's taking statements about COVID and statements about... sickness, and he's having to change them on the fly, and he's not... what you can tell is that he's not comfortable, but he doesn't care enough because he needs the money, so he's like, fine, like, job. You know, again, it's Iran, guys, so, you know, he's not gonna sit there and tell the Iran government, no, I'm not gonna do what you want, like, that doesn't end well for anybody in Iran. So fine, I can do it the way you want, but he's like, but yeah, we're gonna have to edit it again, and they're like, fine, just do it.
Yeah. So I mean, this is the thing, like, this is where, you know, filmmaking kind of becomes brave, because, you know, it is... I don't want to go so far as saying that it's critical of the regime or anything like that, but it's definitely pointing out the hypocrisy of, like, you know, editing experts' testimony and,
it's,
you know...
It's the same... This is why, again, you know, the fight between the Americans and the Iranese, and these are the freedoms that Americans talk about. Like, he is expressing his view... on the Iranians. But, you know, people said this kind of stuff about Trump all day long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, the Iranians are interesting. Like, you know, it's at some equally kind of quite an open society, and then also kind of not. And some of the films that come out of Iran are really, really incredible.
Yeah, you're really good, like, right? Really good. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, it was, out of those, as I said, it was our favorite because it had that deep, deep message. And that's just the kind of stuff we like. Like, it had a social commentary to it because it was from Iran, because he was talking about kind of... And the other interesting thing was to see inside Iran during COVID, because, again, it's a country that sometimes has media blackouts like that, where we don't... Right. always know. And, you know, I don't want to sound too American with that, because I'm like, I have plenty of Iranese friends not from, you know, that are from Iran and live outside of Iran. I don't go to Iran myself, but mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? Like, I had lots of friends that were in the Persian Jew community in L.A., pure mm-hmm. Persian Jewish community, sorry, in L.A., mm-hmm. like, and it's a very rich culture. And so that's what I mean. There should be lots of stuff coming out of here. You know what I mean? Modern culture, contemporary, but, you know, sometimes the curtain drops and, you know, the regime is guided by other things. So, you know, like, I'm not knocking that. We've traveled the world in an eye to know that, you know, we don't have one way of doing things. There's no one way. But it is nice when things come out and they, you know what I mean? And they do get to showcase, the beauty of that
and
culture.
It brings me joy as well that he's like a horror fan. You know, like, I can't imagine that it's that easy to, you know, get hold of horror films there. But, really good. Really good short film.
So, I mean, you know, only other thing to talk about, I guess, would be, and I thought I'd have more to say about it, but now I'm like, what do I really have to say about it?
Oh, okay, come on.
I got to see Dandelions on the big screen. That was awesome. Like that, you know, and Ed was laughing at me because we walked into the movie theater and it was like, I want the middle seat. And he was like, don't you want other people to watch your film? I'm like, no, I want to watch my film. Like, and I want to see how other people react to it.
I love it. I love it because I'm, you know, typical nervous, you know, in the back kind of person.
This is why I always feel like an asshole, because it's like every other actor, director, everyone else I talk to that has any talent is like, I'd never want to watch my stuff. And me, I'm like, I love watching my stuff.
it was great, and it looked great on that big
the thing. Now, the only thing I still wasn't happy with, for some reason, I've never been able to fix that initial lag on the camera, but maybe it's just because it was there. So there's a lag when it opened that only I probably noticed, but the benefit is you have Ed's booming vocals to distract you so no one else notices it. but, you know, it had the sublime shot, and the sublime shot blown up was like, pretty? It's so pretty.
That was a good moment.
That was it, though, really.
It was awesome seeing it on the big screen.
And as far as the other stuff, like, what I was talking about before, like, Ed was really cool. Like, he basically just tried to make sure I was where I needed to be and I could talk to people. You know, I do have the gift of gab, I guess. And so he kind of sent me out in the wild and said, you know, let's go make some friends. You know, and we did. And we had a really good time, and the interview was fun. It's the first time I've been interviewed like that. You know what I mean?
The interview was awesome, dude. I loved the whole setup, the green room thing, and you know, they definitely did it right. And
yeah.
It looked fantastic.
Yeah,
and you were great, man. You were your charming self. You had your what are you guys talking about podcast t-shirt on, which I loved.
I did, didn't I? So I think
it was awesome.
I think the beauty of stuff like this is, like, this for me, and I was talking about this with Brad, like, I became a filmmaker because it's what I'm passionate about. Okay, it is the thing I'm passionate about. And at every film festival, I know that. Because I know when I talk to other people that we get on these really cool conversations because of that passion. And so that's why when I came up to the people from Magpie, it was so cool because you had two other filmmakers that were like, oh my God, we made a film. And I'm like, oh my God, I made a film too. They're like, oh my God, making films is so cool. But there's a discussion there over, well, how did you make your film and what you did. And you'll find, you know, this is where you can kind of spot those. It's funny, we've been... I've been accused of this before, but I am not one of these, like, producers that's in it for the money. Like, first of all, I don't have any money to put into films. I put in money into some films, but not a lot. And, you know what I mean? I have to fund my own films. But there are plenty of people out there that, like, give $200 to a movie and then just try to talk film and don't know what they're talking about. And, like, don't get me wrong. Like, those people don't have the passion, though. That's how you find out. You go out and talk to them, and all of a sudden they start trailing off when they're trying to talk about the next thing they're working on, and you're like, oh. So, but nobody at Rumford was like that. It was really cool. Like, everybody was just one of those, like, uber enthusiastic, really wants to make it, doesn't care how cheap it is, like, let's make a film. So, really pleased with that. And it just was nice to be in that community. It's the first time I felt kind of as part of that, as opposed to someone who, like, you know, goes up and talks to those people.
Well, no, like I told you, man, like, you know, going to film festivals with a film, it's so different and it's so much more exciting. You know, you just feel the excitement from other people that you've made a film. You know, you have the excitement, and like I said, you know, Spencer did such a great job, like, putting it together and making people feel so welcome. I think we should get him on the podcast to talk about
definitely drop him a line to see if he'd be interested. He's got lots of stories to tell, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Part of the reason we get along is we're storytellers, me and him, and man, he's got the better ones, I can tell you that much.
And, you know, talking to Oliver, who's the director of the Magpie, you know, we're going to do something with those guys, I'm sure. Like,
yeah, that's the other thing. The only thing we're sorry about is we completely forgot, Scott, that you were going to be there. Scott Lyas, yeah. We've been meaning to catch up with you and say hi, because everybody we work with talks about you, and we've met you before, but we were really hoping to catch up because he had Black Mass that was showing that evening, which is a really good short. If you haven't seen it, go ahead and catch it. It's another one of his, you know, good lineups. But I felt bad about that because he's... The whole thing we're trying to do, Ed and I, is get out there and raise the profile. And, like, not just talk to other filmmakers, but get us all working together. Because it's just, it's easier when we've got a long list of people who are all willing to work on films, and we can all make the films we want a lot faster because we have the resources that we need.
And find talented people, and, you know, like, it's just, whenever we do one of these things, we always feel so good afterwards.
Yeah, like, and it's why it's important. Know. Like I said, the Facebook requests go out on the Monday after. That's the other thing I will say that I learned from my day job, so my insurance job. When you meet people at these things, the important thing is to follow up as quickly as possible. Why? People will remember you then. If you follow up 2 weeks, and this happens, 2 weeks, there's a good chance people will be like, I kind of remember who you are. Trust me, you do it a month later, and people will be like, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, and everyone will be nice to you, but if you want momentum and you want people to help you, then right off after talking to them. And then call them and get them on the phone again. It's the kind of thing you have to keep the momentum going on these things, because it will fade out after a point. And that's not because people are awful. It's just because... we're on to the next thing. You know what I mean? That's how everybody is. So once you go to these things, hand out business cards, get the business cards, and follow up as soon as you can.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we are at an hour 20, my good man. I didn't think we... At 9 minutes, I was getting a bit worried because we were already talking about Manos, and I was like, God, we're going to run out of time here. But we have managed to ramble ourselves to an hour 20.
There's lots to talk about. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, it was fun.
So thank you all very much for joining us. Like we promised, next week, The Love Witch comes your way. And I do tell you to watch that film. It is a fun film. Samantha Robinson, like, coolest actress in a long time. Just totally gets the Hollywood glam in it. So
And I want to get this on the podcast because I want to make sure that it happens. Jason showed me, the film that may have changed my life the most. On the Saturday night.
So our celebration film,
And we're gonna talk about it. And it's The Gamers from 2002. It's a 47-minute long film, and we're gonna do a podcast on it because
we're gonna be making something similar to it. Just say it.
Well, yeah, it inspired a lot of things.
We are working on a new comedy series that is going to have elements of that, and a lot of elements of a lot of other D&D stuff. But
you like gaming, like, you have to watch this. Like, I feel shame that I hadn't watched this before.
It just was the right time, because we had our little spiritual in the forest, and we were all feeling good about the day, and then we came back, and we were talking about this concept that we're working on comedy now, because we want to write some comedy. We want to make a comedy series. And it was awesome, because this is what happens with two filmmakers. Because Ed's like, what do you want it to look like? And what do you want? It's like, I know exactly what I want it to look like. Watch this film. You'll agree with me by the end of the film. It wasn't even by the end of the film. It was within 5 minutes.
It was
this is what we'll do. And I'm like, good, fun, done. Yeah. And it's not like we're stealing the gamer's idea, guys. That's where you use a reference. You say, we'll write our own content, and it's not going to be exactly like that film, but we know what we want it to look like. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's going to definitely be a big inspiration. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which was something that I think is really important for, you know, filmmakers who collaborate with people and working with people and spending time with people. So Jason and I had an amazing couple of days, but we did have a kind of semi-argument on the car ride back from the festival.
Right? Which, if you know me, having one argument in 3 days with me, like, that's a miracle. That's a miracle.
But I will say that, you know, we always talk about how important it is for us to, you know, like, have a good time and make sure that we people who work with us want to work with us again. But it's also important to remember and to understand that, you know, out of those conflicts, out of that kind of, like, energy that you can have with someone, like, amazing things can happen. Mm. And, you know, I think that it can be tough. And I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of filmmakers tend to be kind of loners, you know, to a certain degree. But if you collaborate with people, you're gonna butt heads from time to time. And, you know, getting over that. You said something which has stuck with me so much, where you were like, I'd much rather have, like, a disagreement with you or a full-blown argument with you over something that doesn't matter, rather than on set, like, day 21 of a shoot, and, you know, you say something that tickles...
You're going to make me blush. I can't believe you remembered that.
That tickles my anus beyond belief.
I thought that's why Ed might be bringing it up, because I did say that. Because I, you know, the reason people argue with me three times a day is what happened there is I cut off, you know, I cut Ed very sharp, and I just said in a very sharp voice, like I do when I'm arguing with someone, I said, this is my position. Like, I understand if you're upset, but this is where we're at. And then we kind of got quiet. We put on some good music because that's what we do. And that's just how it goes, guys. But then when we could talk again, which wasn't much longer, it was like 10, 20 minutes down the road, then I turned to him and said, listen, like, that has to happen now. We need to be in close quarters now, because I am annoying to anyone in the long-term shit. My wife's probably sitting upstairs right now being like, will he just get off the podcast so I can go to sleep? Because I'm a loud guy, and I have my opinions and all of that. Like, that doesn't make me horrible to work with, guys. It just means that over time it can grate on some people. So I need to know that with everyone we're working with, because these shoots are ridiculous. Like, there'll be long days. Everyone's going to have a million things to worry about. And the last thing I want is personalities getting in the way. So when when Ed and I got into that, it was like, well, this is great, man, because now we know kind of where boundaries lie with this, and we understand what kind of things that can set us off. I had made a really callous comment about Ed in film festivals and interviews, and Ed has tons of experience with that. Like, he's been doing this for a long time before me, and I talk as if I've been doing this for 20 years, and I haven't. I've been doing this for like three.
But regardless of what it was about, it had more to do with, like, you know, self-esteem and like, you know, I shouldn't have given a shit about what you said. But the point is that it's almost better that you did see me upset, right? And you did see me, like, kind of how I am, like, because my brother's seen this a lot.
Yeah.
Right? Most people don't.
It's crucial.
Most people don't.
It's critical.
Most people don't get to see, like, pissed off Ed, because, you know,
you know, you count them on my hand the amount of times I've ever seen you angry. You know what I mean? That's me. I'm the guy that gets pissed off about everything. So,
but you're
also
very good at overcoming things as well, which, you know, like, is, again, so important, because, like, I hang on to shit, you know, and that's bad. It's not healthy.
No, and it's just all we're pointing out, and I like the analogy to the lone wolf. I am not a fan of the lone wolf director. I don't think they work. I think, unfortunately, it leads to either spending too much or thinking that your idea, and this is coming from me, guys, thinking that your idea is amazing when it's not. You know what I mean? Like, trust me, I am very braggarty about all the things that I write and all the things I create. But the minute you turn to me and say, it's shit, Jason, I'll either do one of two things. I will either argue with you and say, actually, these extra bits you're not considering, or I will agree with you. And Ed can tell you, it's like a 50-50. Like, you know, if you look at something and say it's shit and I can't explain to you why it's good, then I'll throw it away. You know what I mean? Like, that you don't get that is my point if you're the lone director saying
precious.
It's all about the art. And it's like, I get the art. Like, I'm totally about the art now, too. It's just the art has to be
balance.
Something that everybody wants to see, because that's why it's film. You know?
Balance.
You want to draw pictures to yourself, you know, then draw pictures for yourself.
Yeah,
if you want to make movies for yourself, no one's going to stop you. But why make them? You know what I mean? Unless that's your dig. You know what I mean?
I mean, there are people out there who are, you know, and they are, well, I'm going to make films that I want to watch and that I like, and people will come to watch them. If that's the case, you know, amazing.
Well, and, you know, James Cameron, sadly, will come and see every single one of your fucking films, even if you don't even care if I like them or not.
But even Zack Snyder, you know, like, anyway, let's not get into that.
That's
again.
A whole other podcast. that'll be like, you know, episode 701, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When we're like, well, now we're living in Hollywood, we can talk about these people.
Yeah, where we have live callers and Zack will, like, call in.
I know. Like, sorry, Zach. We really do love you. I just, I'm a hard guy when it comes to the money. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Remember to check us out on lovevictoriaproductions.com or on SoundCloud or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You know the rest, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Please like, share, subscribe, comment. Let us know what you think.
about anything that we've said, any of the filmmakers want to make commentary in the comment section and talk to us about their film, explain maybe certain parts of it, that would be awesome too. We're all about
discussion. If you want to come on.
This is like it, man. It's not about name and shame. It's not about anything we've said on this. It's not about, oh my God, you did it so wrong. If it's not to our liking, we're just honest, like, because we get it about our stuff all the time too, so don't worry. Like, people don't all like all our shit either. But we really believe in the discussion and in looking at things and being critical on them to make a better film the next time around. So, you know, by all means, if people want to talk, we're up for it. We're more than welcome to put anyone on the show that they can talk a little bit to indie film and their experience in it. But catch us next time, and you will be catching The Love Witch.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.